Today's episode is brought to you by Musical Theater Radio's merch store. Looking for that perfect gift for someone or just want to treat yourself to some great musical theater themed merch? Head to musicaltheaterradio.com and click on the All Things Theater button on the homepage and check out all the different designs available. And now, today's interview. Welcome back to another episode of Be Our Guest here on Musical Theater Radio. I am your host, as always, Jean-Paul Yovanoff. If you are in New York City, November 9th, 2023, head over to 54 Below to catch James Rich Salutes Nat King Cole, where he will recount his journey of researching, writing, and developing his new musical, There Was a Boy, which is all about the life of Nat King Cole. So without further ado, let's welcome back to the show, James Rich. Hello, James.
Hello there. Yay! Hey, everybody.
It's great. I love having guests come back because we can catch up. It's been, I don't even know how long it's been since we last talked.
It's been at least a couple of years, I think, yeah. At least since 2021 or something like that, maybe.
Well, you were just about to go on tour.
And yes.
So that was, yeah, whatever the heck that was.
Yeah.
So, well, let's catch up for our guests. You know, I know you've introduced yourself the last time you're on, but Let's get our 30-second bio again. So, James, who are you in 30 seconds?
And I'm going to try and do better because I think last time I did like a 5-minute bio. So, who am I? Who is James Rich? Well, I was born in Alabama. I grew up in Connecticut. I have now lived in New York for the majority of my life. Graduated from Syracuse University with a BFA in musical theater. I consider myself a creative chameleon because I'm a singer, actor, playwright, costume designer. I've done, even dabbled in little producing, small projects. I've been very fortunate to perform on Broadway, off Broadway, lots of regional productions, dabbled in TV, film, even did a few commercials and soap operas, love dogs. French fries are my go-to comfort food. I once ate an entire chocolate layer cake in one sitting. Probably not something I should be proud of or sharing, but it did happen. And I am obsessed with Nat King Cole. That's it.
Well, that's a good thing that you're obsessed with Nat King Cole. If you weren't, that'd be weird for you to be
right. The cake, not so much.
Yeah. So I want to go back to the French fries for a second.
Okay.
What type of fries are you? What is your favorite type of fry? What's your least type of fry? Because I know what I have, but what's you?
I have an air fryer in my kitchen. Mm-hmm. And so I don't really like a lot of oil anymore.
Yeah.
So I do this thing where I'll slice up a good old russet potato, leave the skin on, sprinkle a little table salt on it and let it sit because the salt will draw the water out.
Yeah.
And you drain it. And I then sprinkle brush a little olive oil on the potatoes, put them in the air fryer for about 15, 20 minutes. They are the best thing. I mean, it is like the best. I probably eat too many of them. I got a little muffin top. So we're going to pull back on that so that on November 9th, I'll look a little more svelte.
Nice. Are they thick? Or are they thin of cut fries?
I guess they're kind of the, they're kind of in between. You know the ones, they're not the thick steak fries. I don't like those because what happens with those is there's not enough crunch on the outside. I like them soft in the middle, but I feel like with the steak fries, they get too soft.
Okay.
Yeah. And with the really thin, with the shoestrings, they're so skinny. They get more crunch than soft. So like the ones that, I guess, I don't know what you call the ones in the middle, but that middle size, but those are the better ones.
Well, listeners, if you want more cooking tips, we can have James back on for how to make fries and how to eat an entire cake in one sitting.
There you go. There you go. Yes.
We'll save that story for
the next time.
Back.
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
So you've got a concert coming up. Let's jump right in on November 9th at 54 Below. Tell us a little bit about, why you're putting it on and a little bit about it.
Yeah. I'm obsessed with all things Nat King Cole. I love his songbook. I mean, it's basically the American songbook. But there's just something about the songs that he chose to perform that really resonates with who I am as a performer. I love romantic love songs. And I think he was one of the greatest, if not the greatest singer of love songs that there's ever been. And so I've never really aimed to be a tribute artist who mimicked, anybody's, I guess in my case, who mimicked Nat King Cole. I mean, you know, you can easily hop on YouTube and, you know, watch the real deal anytime. So for me, it's always been about paying homage to his music and his legacy in a more unique and original way. So for me, it's more about keeping his spirit alive in a fresh and contemporary light. So with that said, the concept of what I want to, of what I will be presenting at 54 Below is, I asked the question, what if Nat King Cole were still a top-selling concert artist in today's world? You know, what would that music sound like? What would it look like? So I'll be doing probably about 10 songs from his catalog. And some of the songs will be done with a very modern twist. There'll be a big departure from what people are used to, from the way people are used to hearing them. But then some of the songs will transport you back to the way Nat originally performed them. And in the heart of the set, I'll be performing a suite of musical numbers from There Was a Boy, which is a musical I wrote about his life. And what I found out from 54 Below about a week ago is that the show, the performance, will be live streamed. Nice. So, it'll be a one-shot deal. It's only going to be live streamed that night. They're going to use 7 professional cameras to capture me in HD. And I'm very excited about that opportunity to present my creative vision to a wider audience and to share my passion for Nat King Cole, but also to showcase my unique take on being in his shoes. So, yeah.
Very nice. Very nice. So tell us, I think last time we were on, we talked about There Was a Boy. Since then, what's happened with the show, you know, to get to the point you are for the 54 Below event?
Well, we were able to capture a virtual archival recording. We were in the middle of the pandemic, so we couldn't be in the same room. So somehow or other, I managed to get about 20 creative people looped into a call to do basically a staged reading. And I think the last time I was on your program, we had actually captured all the content. I had not seen anything. And I was preparing to go to Vancouver to do a holiday concert. And after I got back from that tour, I finally got to see the footage from the virtual capture and to see myself, which is something I had never really had a chance to do before, because I was always wearing so many shoes as a producer, as the writer, as the lead actor, the costume person, or doing whatever needed to be done. I was doing all those things. And when I watched it, you know, I guess we're all our own toughest critics. And I have been told by my friends that I am super tough on myself, but I guess I know nothing is perfect, but I do have high expectations when I do anything. Mm-hmm. And so I wasn't 100% happy with what I saw, and it was no one else's fault. I just wasn't 100% happy with it. So I brainstormed a way to enhance the content to be able to share it with potential, you know, people that I wanted to support the project. And that process, I accidentally dropped a light source on my new laptop computer.
Jeez.
Yep. So I needed to have the screen replaced and the motherboard replaced.
Holy Christ.
It's an Apple, and they don't always have those parts in stock. So it took a lot longer than expected to get that repair done. So got that done. And after that was all settled, I was on a roll again, you know, getting this project together, going to get it out to people. It's all excited about that. And then the external hard drive detached from my computer, hit the ground, and became unreadable. The external hard drive contained the sole copy of the virtual reading content. So after a number of additional months, I had to send it away to Ohio. This company, they took it and I guess they call it a clean room, and they were able to recover the data. So I get it back, and I was very happy when I hit play and the video started playing, some of the videos. So the raw data, that was all salvaged, but the Final Cut Pro projects with all the edits, none of that survived the recovery.
Yeah. Start again?
Yeah, so that put me in the place, in the position, because I couldn't, at that point, I couldn't afford to pay another editor. So I've had to learn on my feet Final Cut Pro and just all this stuff. So that put me in a position of having to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. But I am someone, one of those people, I have a really strong belief that everything happens exactly when and the way it's meant to happen. And I know that it's probably my stubborn, partly my stubborn Capricorn nature that makes me square up with defeat. And I refuse to give in when it comes to things I deeply believe in, like there was a boy. And all that to say that I genuinely and wholeheartedly think that this project is an important story for the world of musical theater. And it's something that I think the world truly needs to hear and experience. Nat's story, I think, is one of the, I think it's one of the greatest stories that's never been told. There have been a lot of tribute shows, but no one has ever delved into telling his story. I think that he holds a significant and enduring place in pop culture and the music and the music history. And his impact on the history of America is profound. I mean, he was a pioneer. He was a pioneer in bridging the gap between jazz, popular music, contributing to the evolution of American music, and his unique blend of jazz and pop and blues paved the way for so many artists, you know, so many future artists. And he was also one of the first African-American artists to achieve widespread success and recognition in mainstream music. And during a time of segregation and racial discrimination, and then he broke the freaking, like he broke new ground by becoming the first African-American to host a nationally televised TV, like variety TV show in 1956. Yeah. And, you know, there was no one else on TV that looked like him. And, you know, this was a, you know, was a landmark moment in the history of American television. And, you know, a really big, like a really significant step toward racial integration in the entertainment industry. And the list goes on, but I'll stop with that. But yeah, you know, it's, you know, so that's where I've been and sort of what's been fueling my fire to really get this show up and why I want to do this, why I'm doing the 54 Below performance. I think it's a great way to sort of refresh people's memory of what I look and sound like, what it looks and sounds like when I take my version of the spirit of Nat Cole on stage. So,
yeah. Well, you were generous enough to let me see what you created. And we were talking about it just before we went on, but I did not know that you had to redo this whole thing yourself.
Yeah. So yeah.
Double congratulations on getting that up and done. Because like we were talking offline, it looks good. it gives you the nice flavor. It's on Zoom. So it's, you know, it is what it is, but it gives you a good flavor of what you're going to see on stage, and you can imagine what you're seeing. So, you know, I think you've got a great base there for letting people know if you want to, you know, producers or whomever to see that. So
I appreciate that.
That's great.
I appreciate that. Yeah. I was really fortunate. I had a really good team working with me. First off, the actors were so generous with their times. You know, we were all in different time zones. And so, you know, sometimes it would be 10 o'clock at night for me working. And that meant if someone was, I guess it would be a little earlier for them, but sometimes, you know, it could be inconvenient. You know, I had one actress who had a 2-year-old kid. You know, so she was taking time out of spending quality time with her kid and her husband to be with me, you know, to do this show with me. Had, you know, another lady in Texas, you know, she had two kids, you know, that were, you know, I guess kind of preteens. You know, again, she's taking time away from her family, you know, and they were doing pretty big roles. Yeah. And then, you know, I had two of my closest and most respected friends, long-term friends, who I think are brilliant, Dwayne Boutte and Matt Falker. Dwayne, I've known Dwayne since easily the late 90s. I did my first off-Broadway show at Playwrights Horizons. And he was in the cast. And I just remember the day I walked in and saw him. He was one of the best actors I had ever seen in my entire life. So it's no surprise to me that he decided to get involved in directing. And so he came on a couple of years. Actually, after you and I spoke the last time, he has come on board since then as a director. And so that's been really cool. And then my friend Matt has actually been with me on the project for a little bit longer than Dwayne, although I've known Matt for fewer years than I've known Dwayne, but I've known Matt for almost 2 decades now. And Matt and I, we had the same college mentor at different universities. Mm. And when I moved to California, Diana suggested that Matt and I meet each other, and we immediately clicked. And so when I got the piece written and I had selected all the songs I wanted to use to tell the story, Diana and her husband suggested I talk to Matt and maybe have him, you know, come on as the arranger. And so he happily came on as the arranger, and he did a killer job with the arrangements. So, so I had a really nice team supporting me along the way. You know, it hasn't been easy, but I knew that going in that it wasn't going to be easy. But I've just been very fortunate to have people that really care about me and the project. It's been great.
I'm just curious, it not necessarily has anything to do with, you know, 54 Below or the show, but someone like Nat King Cole, incredible, just this incredible performer and person. I'm always curious if people that good would be able to translate to today. Would their talent be so much that it would translate, or is today just so different? You know, with our pop stars and our, because the whole definition of what a pop star is, and because so many people don't play instruments anymore, right? Yep. They're performers rather than musicians and artists. Like, I'm always curious. What would your opinion be?
You know, I think someone like him, I think he would still have some appeal. But, you know, I just think about, you know, when we watch people like the Adeles of the world, you know, and, you know, God rest her soul, but, you know, the Whitney Houstons of the world, you know, they were all part of a very current pop music industry. But yet when they're on TV, or when you knew that they were going to be performing somewhere, you felt like it was a big event. It's like, oh my God, I'm going to see a real singer. Not that, you know, the other pop stars are not real singers, but, you know, they don't need a bunch of dancers around them to do a concert. You know, it's a real concert. So I think that someone like Nat Cole, I think he would have endured. I think that because of the style of music he performed, that's something that as he matured, he just got better and better at performing it. Interestingly enough, I ended up, was this after or before? I don't know if it was after I talked with you or not, but I got invited to Nat's 100th induction into the Jazz Hall of Fame. And his brother at the time was alive, Freddie Cole. I got invited, and I just remember walking in. First off, I was so starstruck. I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to meet Freddie Cole. And so I get in and just beyond being starstruck, just sitting there in the audience and watching someone who, when he was younger, you know, he did a set of all Nat's music. Watching him play that music, that was music from his youth, you know, his version of pop music. And watching him do that, I was like, oh my God, I have never really experienced this music like this before. And it's a whole other thing when you're watching somebody who that music was just part of the fabric of who they are as a person. And so watching this guy all these years later play that music from, you know, from a time long ago, and just watching how the audience, and there were people in the room who were younger than I was, they were even jamming to it. But, you know, the cool thing with Freddie is, you know, he had all these younger musicians around him. So they were adding like all these cool kind of licks and hits and stuff, yeah, still being true to the, you know, to the style of music. But all that to say that I think that Nat would have found a way to change with the times and made his music more, made his music resonate more with the day. Okay, not to name drop, but fresh out of college, I did go on tour with Harry Belafonte as one of his backup singers.
Yeah.
I will tell you, the way we did the Banana Boat song, very different from the way he did it in the 50s. It was much more contemporary. And I mean, even then, that concert kicked.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, so I can only imagine that if Harry did that, Nat would have done the same thing with his music, and it would have totally resonated with today's audience.
I think talent, cream just rises to the top, right?
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't 100%. Matter where, and he would find his niche.
Oh, yeah.
It might not be in the pop world that, you know, we live in now, but, you know, Michael Bublé, he's carved out a nice niche for himself.
Exactly. Yes. So
and maybe it's just me, but I'd seen Nat Cole going in that direction, still huge, but just, you maybe not hear him on the radio all the time, but you know what? Yeah. We all know who he is because. Yeah. So
honestly. Yeah, yeah. 100%. 100%, man.
So how do people, well, before we get into the how, have you got anything else on the go? Anything else that you want to talk about?
I have been doing some things. I had taken some time away from performing to kind of, I was so dedicated to writing this project and getting it up on its feet. But last year I started doing some stand-in work on TV film, which is not an area I had ever really pursued. I'd done some TV film stuff, but I'd never really pursued it full time. I just felt more comfortable in live theater. Mm-hmm. And from doing the stand-in work, I had a chance to be up close and personal watching some of the best actors in the industry. I ended up being core on a TV show for the entire season. So I was literally watching award-winning actors every day on set. Wow. And just watching what they did, I'd come home and, you know, play around with what they did on, you know, set up my little camera. And so when the show wrapped, I started submitting myself for self-tapes. And I ended up shortlisted or being offered roles for 5 of the first 10 shows I auditioned for.
Wow.
And, you know, some of them fell through because they were, you know, they were smaller projects, but yeah. Then one of them stuck. And so I did a short film over the summer. And then a few weeks ago, I submitted for another project, you know, did the whole self-tape thing. And within a couple of weeks, I got word that I will be the lead actor in an upcoming short film. And so I'll be filming that at the end of November. It's a piece called Earnestly Yours. A young writer, director, producer type person. And it's a really fun script. It's a romantic comedy. So I'm looking forward to that. And I recently had the honor of singing on a demo based on Eleanor of Aquitaine. This wonderful actress that some of you might know, her name is Jane Atkinson. Her father, she's a British actress, and her father had been writing this piece for a while. And she decided that she wanted to, for his, I think it was his birthday, she wanted to surprise him with bringing a couple of the musical numbers to life. And so I got hired to sing the role of King Henry II. So it was a lot of fun. You know, so I've been, you know, getting my feet wet again, getting back into the industry in a more robust way. So that's been a lot of fun.
Well, congratulations on everything you've got going. And, you know, I'll have to listen for these demos and
shows
and everything like that. Yeah, that's awesome. So time for the self-promotion. How do people find out more about you? How to get tickets to the studio, to Fit Four Below, et cetera? We need all that information.
Yeah, they can go to the 54below.com website. And when you get there, just you can either click on the calendar or type in my name and it'll take you right to the page. And that information is all there. There's also a link. I also have links in my on my Instagram and Facebook pages. It's just my name, James Rich. So can't miss me. I guess, well, on Instagram, it's James Rich NYC. On Facebook, it's James Rich. I also have an event page on Facebook. And if you're extra curious, you can go visit my website, james-rich.com. So all those places you can find the information. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, people should definitely be checking that out and checking out There Was a Boy. You know what? See what just give a little flavor of what you've been working on, because I think it's a great project, and what I've seen of it and heard of it, you know, I think it's going to go somewhere. So I'm going to follow along and see, and obviously help promote whenever I can, if wherever it goes in the future. So
I do appreciate
congratulations
that.
On everything. Thank you. That's awesome. All right. We were just speaking with James Rich. He'll be at 54 Below November 9th, 2023 with James Rich Salutes Nat King Cole. So make sure to go check that out if you're in NYC in November of 2023. All right. Tune in next week as we'll speak with another guest or guests about the life, love, and passion that is musical theater. I am your host, as always, Jean-Paul Yovanoff. And until next time, I'll see you when I see you. Welcome back to another episode of Be Our Guest here on Musical Theater Radio. I am your host, as always, Jean-Paul Yovanoff. Today's guest is the co-founder of 30 Saints Productions, created Broadway Songbook, was an artistic director, producer, creator of musicals, director, choreographer, and probably half a dozen other things I don't even know about yet. To tell us about some of the things he has going on right now, let's welcome James A. Rocco to the show. Hello, James.
Hello, how are you? Nice to see you, Jean-Paul.
You as well. It's funny, you know, just to give a backstory. We talked online on email about 8 months ago. I played some of the songs, and then technology decided to rear its ugly head, and my emails got lost. So this
it, absolutely.
This, yeah. So this interview was supposed to happen, I think, 6 months ago. So, which is, but you know what, that's okay. You've got so much stuff going on now that we got lots to talk about.
Well, I was so embarrassed when I lost all this email. All of a sudden, I think I mentioned this to you a couple of weeks ago, all of a sudden 500 emails showed up, some as far back as 2013 that had been caught in some kind of filter on my website, and I got them. I'm not exactly the most hip to the internet. So, you know, I probably pressed a button and next thing I know, I missed these emails. So I'm glad we reconnected.
Yes, I'm so happy. So before we get into all the stuff you have going on right now, let's get to know you a little bit better. So I always ask for a 30-second bio. So my question is, who is James in 30 seconds?
I was a child actor in New York City. I joined Equity in 1969 and toured with Oliver and then played Enoch Snow Jr. in John Raitt's last couple of productions of Carousel. So I did that, and that led to an entire lifetime of doing music and theater.
Wow. So I guess you were always into musical theater growing up, but I'm always curious, was there something else you thought about pursuing?
Actually, yes. I took a year off when I, in my very, very early 20s, and explored being a chef. And I did that for a year and decided that I really wanted to do music and theater. You know, I figured since I had a career as a child, as a performer, and actually as a director, I directed my first show when I was 16 in New York. I thought in my early 20s, I really should think about this. And is this just something that happened? You know, because it was kind of circumstance. My family is musical, but none of them are in the arts. My father had hoped that I would become a librarian. My uncle wanted me to be a lawyer, you know. I come from a big, giant Italian family, and they all had plans for me. I don't think any of the plans were that I would be an artist.
Wow. What drew you to being a chef, maybe?
Well, you know, again, I come from a big Italian family, and food is a big, you know, is what glued us together. And I happened to live upstairs in New York City. I lived in a wonderful apartment building for over 30 years where we all moved in at around college age. And so we remained friends and helped each other. We're in fact, many of us are still friends. But the person who lived downstairs from me had a catering company. And so in between gigs, she would offer me the opportunity to make some money, very good money, you know, and come in there and I would chop and assemble and do whatever the chef, you know, suggested. And one night the head chef didn't show up. And we basically catered television and radio commercials. I mean, television commercials and films. And so basically we would, cook all night and send the food out in the morning to the sets. So one night the head chef didn't show up and my neighbor wasn't available. So she wasn't there and I don't know exactly why I couldn't reach her, but having directed shows, somehow I decided, well, she's my neighbor. I can't let this evening fail. So I took over. I just started directing people, you know, you do this and you do this and you do this. And we assembled the food. The next morning when she showed up, she said to me, "Oh my God, what happened? And thank you for doing this. But don't worry, you'll never have to do this again. I'll have somebody." P.S. She wasn't able to find somebody to chef the next night. All of a sudden I was head chef.
Oh, wow.
And I did that for a year. And it was, you know, it was kind of more like managing, but I did know how to cook and I did know how to direct people. So that's my crazy story. I don't think anyone's ever asked me that before.
You are living proof that the arts is so important in school, because if you, no matter what job you go into, what career, directing and working with people and knowing how to, you know, improvise, important no matter what you go into. So, you know, thank you. That's a good PSA. I think you should figure out.
Yeah, I actually out there. Thank you. You know, I actually will probably do that now that you pointed it out. I agree with you. I tell people all the time that even if you don't end up becoming an artist, just learning about how we do these things makes it possible for you to transition into something as simple as lighting, you know, design, or even just working as an electrician. All of a sudden, I know how to rewire a lamp in my house.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm pretty, unless I learned it in the theater, though, I'm pretty lame. I was living in Oklahoma City and I was the producing director of Lyric Theater of Oklahoma for a while, a wonderful experience. And I was living in the house in Oklahoma City. Now I'm a New York City guy. So I'm in Oklahoma City living in this house and it's winter and it's cold. And I keep telling people, you know, it's really cold in this house. It's really cold. And finally, this friend of mine, I think it was Ellen, she said to me, "Did you turn the pilot light on?" And I was like, what's that? And she explained it. It was like, there's no pilot light in the theater. I never heard of that before. And then I was terrified. You know, you had to light a boiler or something. Yeah. Like, what is this? But now I'm, you know, so anyway.
No.
if you did it in the theater, it's been applicable to life. Not done in the theater, I don't know what's happening, like the internet. My email.
Like you said, you acted as a kid. You've been acting for a while. When did you start transitioning into other things? You said you directed at 16. But when did you start, you know, you started a production company. You started doing all these other things. When did you start to, you know, transitioning?
Oh my gosh. I think right away. You know, I always had it in my head that artists created work for each other. So even as a kid, I was coming up with like projects for all the other kids to do. And frankly, I would always pop myself down next to the director or the producer. So I remember when we were doing Oliver, when I was first doing Oliver, and you know, this is a big step for me and exciting. Instead of playing on the breaks with the other kids, I just plop myself down next to the director. And that's how I ended up with lines in the show. You know, I ended up playing, I was just one of the workhouse boys. And all of a sudden, you know, the director said to me, oh, you can be the book boy. You know, in the second act, there's like, you know, the book shorted from the bookseller, sir. And that's how I ended up with lines. But more, I was interested in how they were putting the show together. And so from the very early days, I was really interested in knowing the nuts and bolts of how it worked. And so it was a very natural transition. In high school, I went to a professional children's school. So we were all working performers, people like Julie Budd and Scott Jacoby and Robbie Benson. And I can go on and on and on, name these people, Irene Cara. You know, we were all in the same school and we were working children. I joke all the time where, you know, I went to a school where we had an answering service at our front desk and they would come and get us and say, you know, you have an audition or you have to go do a shoot. There were at the time, there were three professional children's schools in Manhattan because you just couldn't go to a regular school and leave. Nowadays, I think they're a little bit more lenient. So my particular school has closed. I think professional children's school is still there. I think there's one of them now. But at the time there were three. And anyway, even in school, you know, even though I was surrounded by people like Robbie and Irene and all that, I would be the one that would say, we're going to do a show in the cafeteria and we're going to do this and this and this. And Stephanie Mills is going to sing Bill Bailey and Irene's going to sing Friends and you're going to sing this. And, you know, I just was that guy.
So let's talk about 30 Saints Productions. Let's just jump to this. Sure. I don't know any of the order of things were created, but it's in the order I'm reading it. So 30 Saints Production, tell us a little bit about you co-founding that.
Yeah, I was working at the Ordway Center for the Performing Arts in St. Paul, Minnesota as the producing artistic director. And I had an opportunity, we produced a very lavish production of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. At the same time, we began producing at the Ordway a series that I had done elsewhere called Broadway Songbook. We decided to add that to the subscription at the Ordway. So I was all of a sudden back to doing kind of an alternate job, which was putting really producing shows that were going elsewhere, because that production of Joseph was going to go to Tokyo through Broadway Asia. And the Ordway did not want to have anything to do with the tour of it. Because I mean, the Ordway is a pretty amazing institution and has plenty of work to do on their own. So for that tour of Joseph to move on, there was going to need to be another producer involved. And my partner, Jeffrey Scott, and I decided that we would put this company together to launch Joseph's tour in Asia. So Jeff and I did all of the producing that in coordination with Broadway Asia to get Joseph to Asia. And that's what led to us starting 30 Saints Productions. At the same time, Broadway Songbook was taking off. So Jeff and I thought, well, let's have we named it 30 Saints Productions because that's our address, 30 St. Albans Street South. So we decided that we would create a partnership called 30 Saints Productions that would be a producing organization and also package the Broadway songbooks to play elsewhere outside of the Ordway. Then that led to us investing in Come From Away and working with the U.S. Air Force. And then during COVID, when things were really, just everything was closing down, I was obsessed with the thought that nothing could stop live theater. Nothing could stop the live performing. So I just started thinking up other projects to do. And I ended up starting to license songs for jukebox musicals. And the next thing I know, 30 Saints Productions also had a little arm of it. At this point, Jeff really is not involved much in producing anymore. Jeff, has a business. He never expected 30 Saints to become a full-time gig, although we were still the co-owners of 30 Saints Productions. All of a sudden, we do music licensing. So I think I've licensed, maybe 20 shows now, maybe 20. I've helped Roger Bean relicense all of the songs for Wonderettes and Shaboom and all of those shows. And I worked with on Ted Swindley's, a series of shows for Ted Swindley. And now I've been working with the Denver Center on her, Christine Toy Johnson. I've helped her license and in the interim licensed my own songs for various shows.
Wow. You never know where things are going to go just from that simple, putting together a producing team to take Joseph to,
It's
crazy. You never know.
I never expected it either. Primarily by that point in my life, I've been working as a producer and a director in performing arts centers around the country and never really, just assumed I would continue directing. I always moonlighted as a singer. So really that was my original plan, was to be a pop singer. I traveled all over the world. I sang with Herbie Hancock. I have an extensive background in singing. And that was my intention. I will say that what happened is I co-created a show called Nightclub Confidential. And that was ancient history. We did the backers audition for Nightclub Confidential. And I originally did not want to be part. I did not want to be on stage. But my collaborators insisted that I do this role in the show originally. We did the backers audition. And within a very short period of time, I was in Duke Ellington's Sophisticated Ladies. It was like a door opened.
Wow.
So I walked through the door. All of a sudden, I went from Duke Ellington's Sophisticated Ladies to Cats. From Cats, I did this production of Jesus Christ Superstar that was directed, choreographed by Robert Johansson and Susan Stroman. And Stroman and I had been friends. And we did this production of Jesus Christ Superstar. I played Judas, and it was supposed to go on tour, and neither Robert nor Susan could direct the tour. And Susan, in her inimitable way, just went, Rocco will do it. And next thing I had directed Susan. I had actually asked Susan to play Charity in a summer stock production of Sweet Charity that I was directing. So, she knew I was a director. So Rocco will do it. And I said, I'm not playing Judas and directing Jesus Christ Superstar, but I will direct Jesus Christ Superstar. And I directed this tour of Jesus Christ Superstar. And it was, again, a door just opened up. And all of a sudden, you know, I was doing The Wizard of Oz and Singing in the Rain and Big River. And, thanks to Wayne Bryan and many, many people who were very, very, very supportive of me and encouraging. You know, and I learned a lot from, I learned incredible amounts from these people.
That's fantastic. Wow. So you brought up a Broadway Songbook before.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, Broadway Songbook is, that's something that really was inspired by my collaboration with Albert Evans. I don't know how well you know Albert Evans, but Albert is a genius. He understands musical theater. Albert and I met in the very strangest way. I was calling, I needed a musical director for a show back in 1975. So I was literally about 19 years old. I needed a musical director for a show, and I was desperate. We were already in rehearsal, and the musical director disappeared. You know, and when you're doing these little fringy things and people are getting paid nothing, they disappear. I was used to it by then. So I'm calling people. And I made this phone call and I said, hello, is Dennis Deal there? And this voice on the other end said, no, Dennis Deal is out of town until whatever, blah, 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 blah. And I just said, do you play the piano? And he said in a very cautious voice, yes. I was like, great. Could you come and audition to be the musical? Blah, 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 blah. Next thing you know, we became collaborators, partners for years and years and years and years. Albert is a genius. And I had a lot of background in music and in the theater. He really had even deeper knowledge because he had studied it, and he dragged me right into it. And it made us kind of these eclectic historians who had theories about, how the musical theater evolved. For me, and Albert to a certain degree, but for me also how pop music evolved. And so that's led to this series where I talk about the origins of a song and then, a topic related to the Broadway musical or a songwriter, or going back to what I was just saying, or specifically the origins of a song. And something as simple as the myth that Irving Berlin only played on the black keys of the piano, or, the things like that. But people found it fascinating, and then you'd sing a song like I Love a Piano, or you'd have guests and sing. And it has just continued on and on and on and on for years now. We did it for 7 years at the Ordway. But I have to say, I've been doing it since I did a show at the Donnell Library Theater probably in the very late 70s called Near Miss. That was the first one that I can remember doing. And that's, I talked about these lost gems, like there won't, like how a song like There Won't Be Trumpets disappeared from Anyone Can Whistle, and yet it was this powerful song that still had a real reason to be there. Or I Wish It So, that I mentioned to you earlier. It's one of my favorite songs. I'm really fascinated by Mark Blitzstein. And when you get a song like I Wish It So or Never Get Lost, it's so mysterious and yet so filled with poetry and depth that and it can apply to so many situations. So I love talking about that sort of stuff, and I still do it. I just did one a couple of weeks ago about Cat Stevens, Billy Joel, and James Taylor. Oh, wow. So, I mean, it runs the gamut of theater to Cat Stevens.
Wow. And you just created another PSA at the beginning of this section is always just ask. You know what? When you said, do you play the piano? You know, people just are afraid to ask because what's the worst that's going to happen? If he had said no, you would have just moved on. But if you didn't ask, you wouldn't have known.
And it's been a lifelong, we're still collaborating. You know, yesterday I was helping him. He was he works with David Armstrong on the Broadway Nation podcast. So he was doing a podcast all about, my gosh, I worked on it with him yesterday, pastiche musicals. Hmm. So we were editing together a podcast for him. Yeah, I know.
So, like I said at the beginning, you have so much stuff going on. I'm, let's talk about Nightclub Confidential. You know, shows. Let's talk about that. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Well, Nightclub Confidential is going to be available for licensing again. It's gone through so many different versions and so many different hands. Again, during the pandemic, with the help of numerous people, Dennis Deal, Laura Kenyon, Mark Sendroff, Albert Evans, we were able to figure out where the rights were now. Mm-hmm. And then with my licensing background, I was able to relicense, because Nightclub Confidential is a jazz noir musical. Okay. Ted Mandelbaum called it the masterpiece of the cabaret genre. It, in the 80s, was this phenomena that just all of a sudden happened. My career began as an adult, and all of our careers began, really. It ran a year in Los Angeles. It had productions, and it had a crazy kind of life. It got optioned numerous times for TV and film, and then none of those were ever made. At which point we all like lost track of what was going on with Nightclub Confidential, and we never actually placed it with a licensing house. So that during COVID, that's what I, another one of the things that I did, I found out how to, where the rights were, how I could get it back on track, because we love this show. It's 50% material that you know, songs like Goody Goody, that based on the idea of a vocal group like the Hi-Los or Lambert Hendricks and Ross. It was really kind of, the thought was we wanted to do a show that celebrated the great days of the Bonsoir, the Blue Angel, the nightclubs that you'd hear about that were basically gone. And we wanted to really do the most modern sounding for the late 50s, early 60s. So we were really modeling it on Kay Thompson. So the lead is called Kay Goodman. And then there's a vocal group called the High Hopes that are like the High Lows, speaking of the nylons, which we were doing before. And it tells this crazy story of an older singing star who has these backup kids who become bigger stars than her. And then she, at the end of the show, is kind of down and out. And she comes back and she shoots them all. That's what's confidential about it. So Albert and I, Dennis, unfortunately, could not work with us on it at this point in time. But he gave us his blessing and said, you know, do something. Bring it into the 21st century. So we rewrote it. We and Dennis and Albert wrote a ton of material that also was really well received. So it's 50% songs, you know, 50% new material. And we rewrote the book so that she doesn't come back and kill everyone. And two of the characters we finally admit are gay. And, you know, so it's a 21st century sensibility, but of a noir kind of confidential.
Nice.
I can't wait to launch it again. In fact, we're going to announce that it's available for licensing in a couple of weeks. And I just can't wait for people to hear it again. There was an album. I don't know if you have it. No. It was never my favorite album, but because I loved the music and all of us weren't really, some of the cuts are fantastic. The original star of the show was a woman named Faye DeWitt. And I don't know if you know, if you are familiar with her, she sings the best Life Upon a Wicked Stage on one of those showboats. I think it's one with Barbara Cook that was done at Lincoln Center. Faye is really spectacular, and she is still going strong. Wow. She is still a force of nature, and her cuts on that album are superb. Denise Nolan's cuts on that album are superb. There's a great recording Steve Gideon did of a song called Crazy New Words that's really, really good too. But the album as a whole, I don't know, there's moments of it that I wish that we had done differently. But, you know, I say to my friend David Armstrong all the time, it's never done. No. You're constantly... You know, probably I'll want to re-edit this interview that we're doing.
Probably. But that's the thing, as artists, we're never happy. No matter how good it is, we always hear, if there's one note, one little note that is off, we're the only one who hears it. But we're like, nope, throw it out.
yeah, exactly. I'm going to redo the entire album. And yet, I don't think Faye would be able to do it now. And God, she's good on some of that album. I just think she, again, these people in the theater, that's one of the things that was so wonderful about listening to your broadcast this morning, hearing Gwen Bird sing Ain't Misbehavin' specifically, you're like, these people were really special. And they disappear. Our work disappears. You know?
It's so true. And just, you know, bring it around. That's one of the reasons why I play those things on the radio station, because there are so many incredible songs from shows that either didn't make it or just were not good for whatever reason. But there's always a gem. There's always a song or two in there that should be heard. And, you know, nobody else is playing them, and you're not going to find them on Spotify. Sorry, Spotify, but that's not going to come up in your list. You're just never going to find it on there. So that's what I want to do. I want to be able to introduce people and go, ooh, I've never heard that. Or as we were talking off air beforehand, yeah, I haven't heard that in a while. So
yeah.
Do
you play Anita Gillette singing OG from Jimmy ever?
I don't.
Listen to it and let me know if you think it's worthy.
I'm not sure if I have it or I have it on LP and I just haven't digitized it yet. I have to look. I can't remember because I have so many things on LP that I have to digitize, which just takes forever.
I know. I was going to say to you, I'll send it to you. And then I realized, have I digitized it? Right. I'm on a bunch of those Ben Bagley albums. I'm on about 25 of the revisited albums. Mm-hmm. Mostly in the ensemble, but occasionally I get to sing a song. But friends ask me all the time, do you have blah, blah, blah? And I think, oh yeah, I have that. And then I realize I don't have Kay Ballard singing I've Still Got My Health on digitized yet, you know, or Mark Sendroff really wanted a copy of We Did Too Many Girls. And it's a crazy, I listened to it because I did digitize it for Mark. And Estelle Parsons and Nancy Andrews singing Sweethearts of the Team when they're, you know, frankly, at least 40. And I loved it. I love Estelle Parsons for that. She told me it was some of the most fun she ever had was doing those albums. So anyway.
So you've got some other stuff coming out. Tell us a little bit about those.
I'm in the middle of directing, choreographing White Christmas at the Fifth Avenue Theater with David Armstrong and Matt Perry's the musical director and a great, great, great team. And what else? We have a new version of a show called Streaking Through the 70s that has been done in Orlando Fringe Festival twice and Cabaret Old Town three times. We did it off Broadway. It was a kind of another oddball cult sensation. I seem to be involved in these cult sensations. And I think I told you this crazy story that we'd get a lot of interest in doing the show, Streaking. And then a theater would all of a sudden get cold feet. And I started asking people what the story was, you know, what is the big deal? Why do you say you're doing it? And then you call me and you cancel. It's represented by Broadway licensing this show. I mean, this show has I Will Survive and Have You Never Been Mellow, Rainy Days and Mondays, Disco Inferno, Last Dance. I mean, it has like 30 gigantic hits. And it's funny show. And serious, we do this whole little protest section, and it's interesting. It's a curious show, and these theaters that do it, as I say, they've done it three times in Wichita and at a small cabaret that's run for 6 months at a time, and then twice in Orlando. Anyway, I discovered that people were afraid of the title, and during COVID. They did it three times in New Zealand.
Oh, wow.
And so I started thinking, what is the story? So I started asking these various theaters, would you do a show called Streaking? And they started saying, no, but we'd do a 70s show. And so we decided to change the title and to rewrite it again and to really look through it. Now, Rachel, there's going to be an optional moment where you could have a streaker. And I think almost everyone that's done it, including the off-Broadway production, when they do the streaker is actually covered up. They're just wearing like a bathing suit or a thong, or, you know, with a big smiley face over anything that could be censored. So it's really a joke. But people loved it. But I guess it's not a good title. So we're going to rebrand it. And it, too, is going to be available for licensing in the next couple of weeks. So I can't wait for that. And actually, that's, as I said, that's handled by Broadway licensing. And we're in the middle of rebranding it. So I guess within a month or so, you'll see the Streaking page will become Hooked on the 70s.
Wow. You are going to be busy. You are busy already, and you're gonna be even more busy.
Maybe I'll call you and see if you want to help me out. Although I love what you're doing. I mean, what a dream.
Thank you.
You said you finally found what you really wanted to do, play music all day.
Well, I was running a give a little background. I don't even know if everybody knows this, my listeners. I used to run a company before doing this, and it wasn't working. So what you do when something's not working, you pivot, right? But then I pivoted again, and I pivoted again, and I pivoted again. When you pivot four times, you've made it a complete circle, and you're facing the same way. And you just go, okay, this ain't working. So I wasn't happy. I wasn't making money. So I said, you know what? Let's close this down. And then I went, you know, I went to Sheridan College in Toronto, and I know how to sing and dance. I have all these LPs and CDs and tapes. You know, let's start a radio station. What the heck about musical theater? And now I'm happy. I'm not making money still, but I am happy. So.
Well, that's fantastic. And do you mind telling us how you do it? Do you literally play music all day, or do you, you know, you do it at your leisure?
No, it's 24/7, 365. It runs. I program a bunch of programs myself. And I have some that are set. And the rest of the time is, I'll be honest, it's the computer choosing them. But I've you know, I list them as specific ways, and I won't bore you with the digital background stuff. But yeah, it runs all day. And I've got about 12, 15 shows that are specific. And, you know, I have a Saturday night party, which I play all the party songs of the musical theater for 6 hours. It's just all the party songs Saturday nights. I have, you know, The Decade That Was, which plays a specific decade. It just plays all the songs from that decade. Just little things like that.
I love it.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Thank you. But I there's so many people out there, and no offense to anybody, but a lot of people say, oh, I love musical theater, but their top five shows are Hamilton, Be More Chill, Hamilton, Six, and Hamilton. And I'm like, okay, you like musical theater, but yeah. I want people like ourselves. I don't need to hear Hamilton and Six and Oklahoma over and over again. I want to hear the Gwen Verdon stuff, the 1963 Buddy Hackett musical that didn't work, but had some great off Broadway.
Right. And I mean,
I was going to say, you need to hear the stuff from the 20s and 30s and 40s because those guys are incredible writers, but you're not going to find them on Spotify when you put in musical theater. You're just not going to get, you know, the Irving Berlins necessarily, unless it's the big shows that everybody knows. So,
yeah. I mean, some of my more fascinating experiences, you know, everyone wants me to dish Cats or wants me to dish. I was involved with the production of Wizard of Oz that originally starred Roseanne, and then she was replaced by Eartha Kitt, who was then replaced by Lillian Montevecchi. All these people played the Wicked Witch. Wow. And then finally Joanne Worley. And it all comes back to Joanne. But everyone wants to hear, you know, about those things. But the ones that I was really fascinated by, you know, I did a production of The Boyfriend and Divorce Me, Darling, all in the same evening.
Really?
And Sandy Wilson came and oversaw it. That was really fascinating to me.
Me too. Know? That's a story I want to hear about. Right?
Oh, sure. And actually, Susan Stroman choreographed the Divorce Me, Darling sequences.
Wow.
She did not do the boyfriend, but she was instrumental in my getting that job. You know, I was Pierre. And for a while, you know, she knew I tap danced. So there I was. But those were the gigs. The first show that I chose to direct was and produce in New York was a revival of Henry Sweet Henry.
Oh.
To me, I'm still fascinated by Henry Sweet Henry. In fact, Henry Sweet Henry, in a strange, bizarre way, relates to the fan culture that we have going on right now. I mean, it's so about these two young people who are following this artist and making their lives, his life, kind of this crazy hell to it. And, you know, it relates to the social media obsession with people. And a friend of mine was talking to me about that a few weeks ago. And she was saying, you know, I should produce a revival and you should think about it some more. Yeah. And I wish she would. I wonder if it would really need to be completely rethought, because I as much as I really like Bob Merrill, mm-hmm. Some of the songs in Henry Sweet Henry are not his best work. Luckily, when I did that revival, I had access to songs that they had cut. So, you know, and I was 16 years old. So I was basically going on my instinct.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So before we get into finding out more about you and where to find it, do you have anything coming into the pipeline? I know you got tons of stuff, but do you have anything that you've got you want to pump up or promote?
I would love for people to get in touch with me about doing Nightclub Confidential or learning more about it. Same thing about Hooked on the 70s. We have a new version of A Country Christmas Carol. I think you play the album. I wish you'd play Jingle I.O. actually, because that's one of my favorite cuts on the album. This country version of Jingle Bells that sounds like Jambalaya. And it's like, it's a 60, I don't know, it's less than 2 minutes, the cut. Yeah. But we have a kind of radio version of it that we've been doing, like a live, it's a live production, but it's as if you're watching a radio broadcast. And I think the show works great that way. I would love for people to listen to my own music on Spotify. I have a new holiday single coming out. I've been working with this fantastic jazz pianist in Minnesota named Rick Carlson. He was one of the original members of the Wolverines, which is pretty big jazz band in Minnesota. And he and I are in the process of making a new album, and we recorded a single that's going to come out in a couple of weeks on Spotify, the Christmas song. And that's what I'm touting. Of course, I want everyone to come see White Christmas here in Seattle.
Yeah, that's a little too far for me. I would love to.
Come on down. You're in Toronto. Well, you could listen to Spotify.
I could do that. But the West Coast, I've never been to the West Coast of the States. That's the one place I haven't been to. I've been to Vancouver. Really? I've been to BC. I've been up there. But I just haven't had the opportunity to get out. And the West Coast is one place I'd love to get to one day. So
I don't get to Toronto as often as I would like. The last time I was there, I hate to even say this because it's ancient history, was I came up there. We shot the commercial for The Wizard of Oz in Toronto. Yeah. I saw Ragtime.
We might have been at the same performance because I saw Ragtime here too. And I was blown away by that.
I was too.
I thought
I had seen the future.
Yeah.
You know, I thought this is gonna be like the next wave of what we see happen in musical theater.
Yeah.
It didn't quite have that impact. It certainly is a remarkable show, though.
Yeah, I remember. Weirdly enough, I do remember some of the scenes because I don't remember anything, but I do remember sitting in the theater watching some of that. And just,
oh my God, Audra McDonald, unbelievable, and Camille Saviola, frankly, it blew me away. I mean, I don't know why she never ended up playing it later. I don't know all those details. I've heard, you know, the stories, but she blew me away. Yeah. Not, I mean, of course, Judy Kaye was great too.
Yeah,
but she always is.
Exactly. Well, you'll have to come to Toronto some point, and for whatever reason, maybe somebody will put on Hooked on the 70s or Nightclub Confidential or something. Who knows? So
that would be great. I would love it. I would love it. I'm still a troubadour. I'm still traveling around the world. It's odd. You don't really have. I've been living out of a suitcase for my whole adult life, and that's what I do.
You know what? As long as you're happy, I think that's all that matters. Like, a lot of people go, my fiance is like, I don't know how you do half the things you do. Like, she's a 9-to-5 or she's a teacher, well, 8-to-4 or whatever it is. So she doesn't like she structure. And uh-huh. Then she looks at my life and goes, how? Why?
It's why you today. It's why you fit. It's why
exactly.
You
fit. So how do people get to learn about you? And tell us the website, the socials, all the fun stuff to get to know you.
Well, of course, I'm on Facebook. I have a website, jamesrocco.com. And we are launching a new website for 30 Saints Productions. As of October 26th, we'll be able to be reached at 30saintsproductions.com. And at 30saintsproductions.com, you can find out all about Nightclub Confidential, all about Hooked on the 70s, all about the songbook, all about music licensing. If you need us, if you're writing a jukebox musical, you write the show, we'll get you the license. It's been interesting to really do that for people, because a lot of people have a dream, but they really don't realize that you need to have permission to use these songs. Yeah. I think I wrote to you about that that's what was the email that I missed. Yeah,
that's what I was interested in talking about. And maybe we can do a whole separate thing to just talk about that and the ins and outs and you know, questions people might have and things like that. Cause I was fascinated by it. Like, cause that is an area that I know so many people are just like, what do I do? And so.
Right. And a lot of people think that they can kind of slip it by. You know, that, you know, I can do this show and then, you know, later I'll get the rights. And you'll just, a lot of times when when I reach out to the publishers, the first thing they'll say is, have you done this show? Mm. You know? Yeah. And it's interesting because some people do. They perform the shows and they don't have the rights. It's such a fine line. I'd love to talk about it with you.
Yeah,
I'm fascinated by that. Some songs, I call them orphan songs, because a song that you may think, oh, I can grab that song. That's an easy one. I'll get that one. You all of a sudden discover no publisher is handling it. Huh. Or there's a conflict. Two publishers think that they own it. And when you get into that, you do not want to be arguing with Sony and Universal.
Yeah.
You're like, you got to let them work this out. And I hate to tell you this, but you're going to have to replace that song, or you can't do it until they work it out. Because there's nothing we can do about working out their discrepancy.
Yeah.
I had to drop a song recently from it. Well, somebody had to drop a song recently from a show that was really sad. And it was very sad for me because the song very much, it's a show about a specific artist. And this artist was truly recognized for singing that song. It's so sad that they can't include that song in the show, but two publishers are fighting over who owns it.
No, maybe it's just me, but this would be a fascinating topic to hear more about. And I know there's other people. So we'll have to have you on again and figure out something to talk about. James, I'm so glad we reconnected and your emails decided to let you know I'm still here. So thank you again. And congratulations on all the stuff you've done. And, you know, I look forward to promoting everything you got going. If you need anything, you just let me know and I'll share it out there.
I'll send you some cuts from Nightclub Confidential, from the old Nightclub Confidential album.
I would love to add those to the rotation. That would be fantastic and get other people to learn about the show as well.
So. Fantastic. And I'll make sure I tell people that we're doing this. So, we're friends now.
Awesome. All right.
All right.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
All right. We were just speaking with James A. Rocco about, well, pretty much everything. 30 Saints Productions, the Broadway Songbook, Hooked on the 70s, Nightclub Confidential. Like, the list goes on. You heard it all in the interview. So make sure to check out his website and everything that he's doing in the next little while. So tune in next week as we'll speak with another guest or guests about their life, love, and passion that is musical theater. I am your host, as always, Jean-Paul Yovanoff. And until next time, I'll see you when I see you.